From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Here and Now. The search and rescue efforts in Surfside, Florida are back in full swing after a controlled explosion brought down the remainder of the partially collapsed condo building over the weekend. But now a possible new threat looms as Elsa brings the potential of heavy rain and strong winds to the area. Let's bring in Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava. Mayor Levine-Cava, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Celeste.
I saw that you noted that the only thing that will keep search and rescue crews off of the pile will be lightning strikes. What do you mean?
Yes, so that is by federal law that first responders need to be out of danger for 30 minutes when there's lightning within 2.5 miles of a rescue site.
But other than that, you feel that they have the equipment and the situation that they need in order to remain searching?
Absolutely. So 30-mile-per-hour winds would be another condition that would keep them from searching. But at this time, we feel confident that the tropical storm has passed to the west, and we do not anticipate, although we are monitoring. We actually have National Weather Service individuals embedded on site monitoring the situation so that if there is any danger, we can stop action.
How much change does it make to have the rest of the condo building brought down? Does that make it significantly safer?
This is totally changing the situation because we could not get to the pile closest to the building before this due to the fact that it was actually holding up the building. So that building, very unstable. We saw it shifting, and this pile was what was keeping it from falling down on the first responders on the site. So very, very critical to bring it down in a controlled way. And we were so grateful to find a company that has the track record and was able to do that expeditiously.
You have a number of priorities battling for your time all at once. One, of course, is this effort of search and rescue. Also, there's the ongoing investigation. At least 4 federal agencies are investigating the building collapse, what led to it, and what may have prevented it. Do you have any news on that front?
So our NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, is a lead on the building investigation, and they have done a LIDAR audit of the structure that before we took it down with demolition. They've tagged all of the evidence from the site. They've begun the interview process with people who had direct knowledge or who were on site and observed things that would be relevant to their investigation. And they will be having periodic updates before they issue their final report and findings. So it is definitely too early to make any conclusions about the cause of this collapse.
I have to assume, though, that your office is taking phone calls from other people in the area who are concerned about the safety of their own buildings. Are you hearing those kind of voices? Yeah,
absolutely. People are, of course, concerned. For the county, which is about 40% of Miami-Dade County itself is under my jurisdiction in terms of buildings, we've launched an audit. We've reviewed all the buildings and the 40-year recertification. We did find only 4 balconies that we thought were unsafe, and the building was not evacuated. But other cities have done their own audits. North Miami Beach evacuated an apartment building. Miami Beach is closely looking, the city of Miami, and we're encouraging others. And we want to be sure that the certification process is timely, accurate, listened to, heeded, that concerns are addressed timely. And there will be changes, I know, in local, state, even federal laws pertaining to building safety. And we will be tightening wherever we can, even before those changes in law occur.
You know, you have singled out journalists and other people for praise for telling the stories of those who died in the building collapse. And I wonder why. What is important to you at this moment when there are so many other things going on? Why is it important to be hearing the stories of people who perished?
This is something that is so unprecedented, so horrific, and really could be any of us. And I think to mark the fact that these victims tragically were lost because of something that could have been prevented, it pays honor, pays homage to them, and motivates us to continue our search and to find the answers.
There are, of course, a lot of people still waiting to hear news of their loved ones and friends who are in their building. Do you have any idea at what point this becomes not a rescue mission, but a recovery mission?
So the transition to recovery will not change the way that we are going through the pile. It will not change the way that we carefully seek people. It will not change the way we catalog the evidence. But what it will do is, of course, for those who are still hoping and praying that they'll find a loved one alive, it will give them that closure to move on. We're not there yet. The families are not there yet. And the family members are communicating with our rescue experts twice daily. They know exactly what's going on, what the challenges are, and where there's still room for some hope.
Just one more question for you, which I know this is not the first time you've had to grapple with a significant tragedy while you were a public servant. And I wonder if you have advice for other people who at this point are feeling overwhelmed with the stress and grief right now.
Oh, my. For me, the comfort is that we have a phenomenal team. Our loved ones are going to be provided with resources to get back to their lives as soon as they're able, and even that our first responders are going to be supported to cope with the incredible grief that they experience as well.
Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levin-Cava, thank you so much for joining us, and we obviously wish you the best as you continue
thank
with this
you.
Process.
Thank you so much.
Well, the weather is getting worse in southern Florida as Elsa moves in. There's a hurricane watch and several tropical storm warnings in effect right now. And a state of emergency has been declared for more than two dozen counties. And as you just heard, the storm is complicating the search for survivors in the collapse of that condo building in Surfside, Florida. Ray Hawthorne is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Ray, thanks so much for taking the time.
You're welcome, Jane.
Where is Elsa now, and how is it affecting weather conditions in Florida today?
So the latest information puts the center of Tropical Storm Elsa about 65 miles to the northwest of Key West, and that position's also about 215 miles to the south of Tampa, which is where we're expecting more significant impacts tonight. So far, Jane, what we've been seeing are tropical storm force winds, generally between about 40 and 60 miles per hour in wind gusts, especially in the lower and middle Keys right around Key West, and we're just starting to see some of the heavier rain bands start to move on shore around Marco Island, Naples, and Fort Myers. And those will be spreading northward later tonight into tomorrow.
So I'm reading about a possible storm surge of at least 5 feet in Tampa Bay. What are your biggest concerns from Elsa? Is it winds this time? Is it storm surge?
So heavy rain is going to be the biggest concern for many Floridians. But as you mentioned, we are looking at some storm surge potential as well. And the greatest chance of that is going to be in that Tampa Bay area. It's very prone. And then a little bit north of there into the Big Bend of Florida, too. You have very shallow shelf waters in that area. So it doesn't take a lot of wind to push the water up. So we're looking at storm surge as high as about 5 feet above normally dry ground. And that would be during the wee hours of Wednesday morning. That's when a high tide cycle comes around, so that's when the water levels are likely to go up. We're also looking for the potential of isolated tornadoes, too. And many areas here in Florida, and obviously it rains here quite a bit, but we've seen rainfall average as much as twice the normal over the last month or so. So flash flooding is going to be a greater concern than usual.
And so give us the storm track. You mentioned it briefly, but where is Elsa headed? Coastal Georgia, South Carolina?
Yeah, so the landfall is likely to be over the Big Bend of Florida coming up early on Wednesday morning. And then after that, it's going to cross through northern Florida and then into coastal parts of southeastern Georgia. That'll be coming up on Wednesday afternoon. And then I think by Wednesday night into Thursday, it'll be moving over eastern parts of South Carolina into North Carolina. So they, too, will be looking at the threat for heavy rainfall, maybe some brief wind gusts around 40 or 50 miles per hour, and also the chance for some isolated tornadoes there too.
It seems like there has been time to prepare for Elsa, but what's your advice, Ray, for listeners in the path of this storm?
Yeah, the biggest thing that I recommend is to continue to prepare if you have not done so already. There are a few spots with some voluntary evacuation, so listen to local officials there. If you're in a storm surge zone area and you're being asked to evacuate, you're going to want to go ahead and do that and move inland just a little bit. Also, there are likely to be some power outages too. Many Floridians and many of us here in the southeastern United States have plans, have disaster kits just in case the power goes out, and that's likely to be the case in the path of this storm. And then also be careful at night too for those traveling around. We're looking at the potential for flash flooding and those brief tornadoes, and that could cause some concerns as well later tonight.
Real quick, last question, about 10 seconds. Is there another system behind Elsa? What are you seeing?
We are going to get a break after Elsa. It looks like the next couple of weeks will be quiet.
Good. Ray Hawthorne is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Ray, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Jane.
The young adult mystery novel Firekeeper's Daughter has spent 14 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It debuted at number one shortly after the book published in March. It is quite an achievement for first-time author Angeline Bulley. She mined her heritage as a member of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa, or Ojibwe Indians, along with her day jobs working for the tribe as well as the U.S. Department of Education. Angeline Bulley joins us now to talk about Firekeeper's Daughter. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You first had the idea for this book when you were a senior in high school, if I read that correctly, and then you didn't start writing until you were 44 years old, and then it took 10 years after that. So why do you think it had such a hold on you?
I think that maybe I'm just a born storyteller and I didn't realize it until just that spark of an idea that stayed with me and it just wouldn't go away. And finally, those like little whispers of, what about this? What if this happened? What if that? Trying to answer that question of why would an undercover investigation need the help of an ordinary Ojibwe girl? And just kind of piecing together that answer until it grew into such a loud voice in my head, like, write this now.
Well, the title, Firekeeper's Daughter, refers to your heroine, Donis Fontaine, who is half Native American. Her father was Ojibwe from the Ojibwe tribe, and her mother was white. It seems as though she often feels like an outsider in both of those communities. And I'm curious, was that something you were looking to explore, that feeling of otherness, you know, being on the outside looking in?
Most definitely, Jane. You know, growing up, my father's Ojibwe, my mother's white. I'm a light-skinned Ojibwe woman. I wasn't raised on the reservation. And so there was that feeling of, I know this is who I am. Like, I always knew my identity. But as far as feeling maybe not enough or too much of something else, I think that was something that I just grew up with. And then I saw my kids go through it. And my whole career, Indian education and connecting with teens and seeing them, you know, they went through similar things. I just really felt strongly about a young adult book that would tackle these complex issues such as identity.
Well, your heroine, Donis Fontaine, is smart. And despite being an outsider, she is scientifically minded. She's athletic. She cares about her family. I mean, this is not a character that we historically have seen in stories about Native American teenagers. How important was that to you to present that kind of role model for your readers?
Oh, it was so important. I was 18 before I even read a story that had a Native main character. And, you know, in studying the hero's journey, I thought, we have heroes in our storytelling, and why not tell the hero's journey, but from the point of view of a young woman who is Ojibwe, who knows her culture, but still feels this outsider-ness, and that it's only when she claims all of the aspects of her identity does she really come into her power of, you know, being the ideal confidential informant, of being just her truest self.
Well, and it is through a couple of personal tragedies that Donis becomes that confidential informant for the FBI, who is investigating the distribution of a particularly powerful form of crystal meth involving the Ojibwe community. As I was reading, I was wondering how this story perhaps intersects with some of the realities, unfortunately, on the Native American reservations today.
Unfortunately, it does. You know, meth really exploded across the country in the early 2000s, and that's where my book is set, in 2004. And it also aligned with when Indian gaming in Michigan particularly was especially lucrative. And so just that crossed paths of meth exploding and tribes having economic prosperity that, you know, they hadn't had before, you know, that was what really drove the time and place of the story.
In the book and in real life, what was the devastation of that explosion of crystal meth, among other things?
It's still ongoing. Meth is still, you know, prevalent in rural communities, not just reservations, but, you know, rural communities, urban communities, because it's relatively easy to make. And, you know, you can have a clandestine meth lab in your car trunk. It really does lend itself to, you know, being able to be cooked next door to you, and you might not know.
You also explore the issue of sexual violence against Native American women in the book. We came across an astonishing statistic that Native American women have been murdered and sexually assaulted at rates as high as 10 times the national average. And these are crimes overwhelmingly committed by non-Native men, but they're seldom prosecuted or even reported. So you wanted to bring attention to this issue by including it in your book as well.
Definitely, because there are predators who know these things, that major crimes are prosecuted in federal courts. And so for many different reasons, someone other than the victim or the tribe are deciding whether or not to pursue charges. And unfortunately, getting justice in the federal courts, you know, it just does not happen for far too many Indigenous women and girls. And we know that there are predators who know exactly about all of the jurisdictional loopholes, and they specifically pick out victims because of that.
Even though you tackle some very difficult issues in the book, you said something in an interview with the New York Times that we just had to quote. You said, "I have a mantra. I'm writing about trauma, but I'm not writing a tragedy. I didn't want to lose sight of the funny and loving and wonderful things about my community, even though I was talking about meth and other unpleasant truths," end quote. And there's a lot of joy and love and good things in this book as well. How much of that came from your past growing up as part of the Chippewa community?
Oh, I spent a lot of time with our elders. When I worked for our tribe, one of my responsibilities was with our elder division, and I would have lunch with our elders. And just the things that they would laugh about and, you know, hearing their stories, that was just one of the best parts of being in my tribal community. And I wanted to honor that and just show how dynamic our elders are. They are not stagnant. So just what a rich addition the elders are to Donis's story and to my community and to other communities as well.
What did those elders think of your book?
They like it, and then they want to know, wait, did you base this one on me? And so that, you know, that kind of dealing with that question. So I like to say I was inspired by my community elders, but no one person informed or based a character.
But these are hard things to talk about and hard things to accept, and for many who have lived through it, devastating, right, in many ways.
Definitely, and was really important to include that. That's as much of about my community as the sad or traumatic things.
A lot of people, a lot of young adults, actually, get their idea of contemporary Native American teenagers from the very popular, the wildly popular Twilight movies. You presented something that was much more truthful here.
Thank you. That was important to me. In fact, I fictionalized my tribal community so that I could have creative license with the story, but also because I felt uncomfortable speaking on behalf of my exact tribal community and telling a story that perhaps I didn't have the authority to do so. I wasn't sure how to tell a fictional story about a real tribe. And so I did, take some creative license with it.
What do you want readers to take away from the book?
Well, first, that it's not just a young adult story, that it really does have appeal for adults and, certainly anyone 14 and up. And then, two, what I really would want is for readers to know that we are still here, Indigenous people. We are still here living dynamic lives, and that we are not a monolith. There can be no one great Native American story. And so just hopefully whetting an appetite for people to want to read more stories about other communities and celebrating the differences between communities and certainly within the community too.
Angeline Bulley's best-selling debut novel is Firekeeper's Daughter. Angeline, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
If you're the lightest shade of brown, is it cool to call yourself a person of color?
It does not feel right for me.
I absolutely want to own my space as a feminist woman of color.
Don't miss our series exploring Latino identity on NPR's Code Switch podcast.
Let's check in on another COVID-19 hotspot. In Indonesia, the country's president has just announced some new measures to fight the spread of the coronavirus, as concerns grow about the potential for a major outbreak there. We're re-airing this report from Michael Sullivan, who tells us Indonesia is leading Southeast Asia in infections and deaths.
President Joko Widodo says the new measures mean shopping malls, schools, and mosques are all closed for the next 2 weeks. In-restaurant dining is also banned, and non-essential employees are to work from home. But the new restrictions only apply to parts of the main island Java and the resort island of Bali. And critics say they fall far short of what's needed.
I think it's like, a cosmetic policy, not the most strongest that can stop the transmission.
Epidemiologist Pandu Riono of the University of Indonesia says that's especially true now that the highly contagious Delta variant has arrived as well.
They said, okay, don't panic. It's become, everybody is already panicked.
With reason. Indonesia has reported new daily records for weeks now. Epidemiologist Diki Budiman has advised previous Indonesian governments.
Currently, almost all hospitals in Java Island already have 98% bed occupancy. And some of them already closed the hospital to receive or in receiving the COVID-19 patient.
Public health expert and COVID data analyst Irma Hidayana also helps patients find beds. She worked to find one for a man whose oxygen levels were plummeting. She tried several hospitals in the capital, Jakarta, with no luck, and she says the nurse at the last one was blunt.
You need to know that we have no wheelchair, we have no bed, and we have no oxygen.
It's the same, Irma Hidayana says, almost everywhere.
June 14 till June 30, we lost 11 people. They died before they got medical help from the hospital.
Diki Budiman warns it's going to get much, much worse in the next month. The new restrictions, too little, too late, especially when they apply to just over half the population.
So at least end of July until mid of August, we still have around 300 to 500,000 cases a day, and the death case will be around 2,000 to 3,000 a day.
A half a million cases a day, he says, in a country where the health system has all but collapsed, with a government, critics say, that's still prioritizing the economy over the health of its people. One that's recently lost dozens of doctors and nurses to COVID, even after they were fully vaccinated with the Chinese Sinovac vaccine.
Not okay. And this is worrying me because then we have an issue of about the effectiveness of Sinovac in the real world again, Delta variant. So that's a very high concern.
A Delta variant that now has the Indonesian government scrambling, with testing, contact tracing, and vaccinations limited. And without a total lockdown, many experts now worry Indonesia could become the next India. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai, Thailand.
In Nashville, the family of a black man shot by police is still reeling after a judge accepted a plea deal that would send the officer to jail for only 3 years. Officer Andrew Delkey, who's white, was to be tried this week for shooting and killing Daniel Hambrick, a black man, in 2018. In court Friday, when the deal was announced, Hambrick's mother, who's legally blind, was restrained by her lawyer after she reached toward Officer Delkey, knocking over a courtroom lectern. Let's listen. Let's bring in WPLN reporter Samantha Max, who's been covering this case for the past 2 years. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm glad you could be with us. Samantha, it sounds like the family did not know about this plea deal. Was it a surprise?
So the district attorney and the family have been in talks for 3 years now since this shooting. And all of the sudden, we had this plea deal just days before this case was set to go to trial. I was going to be in court today for jury selection. And the family says that they were not consulted before this plea deal was agreed to. So essentially, you know, there was always the possibility that this could happen. So many cases, the majority of cases really end in plea deals. But the family is saying that by the time that this decision had been made, the defense and the prosecution, they'd met, they'd discussed this option, they'd decided on it, and the family was just kind of told, this is what's happening.
The officer was set to go to trial for first-degree murder charges. What does the plea deal include?
So instead, Andrew Delkey has pled guilty to voluntary manslaughter. If he had been convicted of first-degree premeditated murder, he could have spent the rest of his life in prison. But instead, he has been sentenced to 3 years, which he will be serving not in state prison, but in the local jail. So that also means that because of good time credits, if he's well behaved, he could get out in about a year and a half. So it's a pretty big jump from what we could have seen if there had been a conviction for the original charge.
And what have prosecutors said about why they took this plea deal?
So the district attorney essentially just said that this was not a slam dunk case, even though he truly believes that the officer wasn't justified when he pulled the trigger because Daniel Hambrick had a gun in his hand when he was running away. The district attorney just felt that he was not sure that he was going to get a conviction. I've also been told by a local attorney in town that apparently both the prosecution and the defense have been holding kind of mock trials with focus groups, and a lot of those have been ending in hung juries. So he just felt like, at least this way, for the first time in the city's history, a police officer would be going to jail for killing someone. But obviously, it's just a kind of different outcome than what the family had hoped for.
We heard a very emotional clip there from the mother reacting. And I wonder, what is the reaction from people who, as I understand, were already outside of the courtroom and outside of the courthouse waiting for updates on this case?
Yeah, it was really emotional being in court on Friday. As I was walking in, I actually walked in with Sheila Clemens Lee, whose son was killed by a police officer about a year and a half before Handbrake, and I asked her how she was doing, and she just said, not good. As I got inside, the entire hallway was just filled with activists who were hugging and crying. And then once Vicki Handbrake, Daniel Handbrake's mother, started giving her own speech and getting incredibly emotional and crying and screaming, everyone was in tears. I mean, I've been in court plenty of times and I've just never seen anything like it before.
The attorney read a statement from the mother, and the statement read, I have contempt for the system, I have contempt for this plea, and then goes on to say, I have a special contempt for Andrew Delkey. This was the first time, as I understand it, that we actually heard from former officer Andrew Delkey. What did he have to say?
So, you know, other than the interviews that we have that he did with state agents after the shooting, this is, yeah, the first time we've heard him speak in court. And it was a little bit of a jarring experience. I mean, he was incredibly nervous, but he was very apologetic. He said that he did not believe that his actions were reasonably justified, that no mother should lose their child, that he thinks about what he did every single day. And something that was really interesting is, whereas his defense attorneys and the police union for 3 years now have been saying Andrew Delkey was completely justified in his use of force, he was just following his training, Delkey, when he took the stand, he said, you know what, I hope that my case contributes positively to a much-needed conversation about how police are trained, suggesting that he thinks the way that he was trained was not right and that it was problematic. So I think it'll be really interesting to see if his words have any impact on our police department here.
WPLN reporter Samantha Max, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Some people say coping with the pandemic has helped them find new connections in their communities. In one small Vermont town, an emergency response is becoming a tradition. From member station Vermont Public Radio, Lexi Krupp reports.
When Erica Hoffman Keyes first heard about people applauding for frontline workers in big cities, she didn't think that would work so well in her town of Thetford, Vermont. The community is spread out. There's about 60 people every square mile.
There are some places in Vermont where you can go outside your door and bang a pot and pan and nothing's going to happen because nobody hears you. The cows might be impressed, but we do have a lot of churches.
Churches with bells. At the height of the pandemic last year, bells rang out from 5 churches and school buildings in Thetford every evening at 7, including where Erica worships, the United Church of Thetford.
It seemed like a way to just let people know that we were thinking about them and that we were thanking them.
While the evening bells at other churches stopped ringing months ago, at the end of last summer when cases in the state remained low, or when the rope for the bell broke at one church, Erica's group has kept at it. Every night for more than a year, someone from the congregation has climbed the narrow staircase at the front of the church to ring the 150-year-old bell. And even from the early days, there was this question.
Kind of like, wow, I wonder how long we're going to be doing this.
In June, 8 of the bell ringers met at the church, along with a shy 2-year-old.
Hey, Bella, how are you?
Did you come to ring the bell?
Hey, yeah.
It was just a few days after Governor Phil Scott lifted Vermont's emergency restrictions, and the first time they'd all been together since this collective project began. Despite this new phase, the overall sentiment from the group is they're not ready to stop.
There's still a lot to do or a lot to sort of move forward with. So it's hard to think of just stopping because of an event at the state house or something like that.
Josh Manette rings the bell Saturday nights. He lives right next door to the church. And he says hearing that sound every evening, it's like a reminder of what we've lost.
Where I've been very fortunate to have the same job, to have sort of the ability to work from home, and many others have not. And many have actually sort of paid the ultimate price and lost loved ones.
Another neighbor, Jesse White, rings on Wednesdays.
It doesn't feel like we just ended this. I'm really happy that we can be sitting here together and we can be gathering in church, but there's so many people suffering and I want to keep going.
In other places in Vermont, some people who came together to support their neighbors during the pandemic feel like they don't have the option to stop.
Yeah, and it's a little scary.
Hillary Gombar has been involved with Winooski Mutual Aid since early on. She says the group got its start when some families couldn't get food from the city's schools or food shelf. She helped organize a food drive.
We filled up I have a Subaru Forester, and it was like exploding with food to the ceiling and out, you know, everywhere.
Since then, Winooski Mutual Aid has continued to deliver food to dozens of families. They hold pop-up markets and winter clothing and diaper drives, filling in gaps where community needs remain. Those needs, though, don't appear to be letting up.
And like how we are now, I don't feel like I could just disappear for a few weeks. And that's not sustainable.
Other social service organizations in Vermont have reported sustained levels of need for things like food assistance in recent months, even as some government-sponsored programs wind down. That means for now, what began for some people as a desire to help their neighbors amid a crisis has no end in sight. For Here and Now, I'm Lexi Krupp in Norwich, Vermont.
Much of the world is not quite back to normal yet after COVID-19. That's according to the results of a new normalcy index by The Economist. It tracks 50 countries and measures their progress toward getting back to pre-pandemic life. Whether people are returning to work in their offices, traveling again, or attending sporting events or going to the movies. James Fransham is a data journalist with The Economist in London. James, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, thank you. Tell us more about this normalcy index. What countries are you tracking and why did you choose them?
Yeah, sure thing. So on Global Normalcy Index is our attempt to measure the world's return to normal, looking at 50 countries, which are basically big economies, the countries with the biggest populations. So our 50 countries together account for about 90% of GDP and about 75% of global population. So it's very good coverage and it, you know, represents a decent portion of the world.
And so what are the results? What did you find?
So we have, as I said, data for 50 of the largest countries and biggest economies. So that index demonstrates what's very clear is that you see in the index value of 100 being the pre-pandemic norm. So the index value falls dramatically in March last year as restrictions came in. And then it's since recovered to about a value of 68. So it's gone from about 30 at its kind of peak its nadir in April 2020 to 68 at present. And then among the global index, so among the country level data, the data varies quite enormously. So at the top of our index is Hong Kong and New Zealand. So two countries that have done well to kind of really stem the tide of infections, and they've closed borders and so on. And at the bottom is Malaysia, and that's just on 27 points out of kind of 100 being the pre-pandemic norm.
I noticed the U.S. is not even in the top 10 countries when it comes to normalcy, getting back to normal life. Where do we stand on the index and why?
Yes, that's right. The US is currently ranked 20th on our list, so it's at 73 points, so sandwiched between China and Portugal. I think America is interesting. In some aspects of life, it is well on the way to normalcy. For example, flights are about 70% below their pre-pandemic level, and that's some of the highest in the world that we're tracking. Sports attendance looks very strong too. Cinema similarly looks quite strong. But other measures are weaker than kind of the global average. So public transport use, office use, road traffic. You know, it's going in the right direction. So that's definitely a good thing. And it's progressing, you know, fairly slowly. I would think what concerns me is that the vaccination rates in America have really slowed down over recent weeks. So that is some cause for concern. But my hope is that you know, they will continue slowly and America will continue on this path to normalcy.
I'm looking at the table here in The Economist. As you say, Hong Kong, New Zealand, Pakistan, Nigeria, Ukraine, all at the top of the list, but those moving away from normalcy, Switzerland, Saudi Arabia, Spain, China, Russia, some interesting and perhaps surprising countries that are not going in the right direction.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the news at the moment, particularly, you know, with infections driven by the Delta variant, that really has meant that a lot of countries have had to bring in restrictions again. Obviously, in the UK here, we're talking about unlocking on July the 19th, but we have infections that are, you know, going through the roof right now. So, you know, the UK is planning to ease restrictions even in the wake of these massive amount of infections. And it can do that, it thinks, the government here thinks it can do that with confidence because it has a good, healthy number of people that are vaccinated now. In other countries, they don't have that luxury. So Malaysia is a very good example of that, whereby, you know, you've had a massive wave of infections. I think deaths are there are about six times higher than they were in January. And as a result of that, you've had to bring in government restrictions and behaviour has dropped because of that. So,
as you've been tracking behaviour over the last weeks and months, James, what particular thread has been most interesting to you?
That's a really good question. I would think that the one that gives me most optimism is the relationship that you see between vaccines and normalcy. So, you know, you can see clearly this very strong correlation in countries that do have a good number of people vaccinated. You see, you know, normalcy moving in step, hand in hand with vaccination programs. So that's the one that, when I see these kind of rising number of infections, that actually, gives me hope at least that, you know, in time, the world will collectively return to normal.
James Francham is a data journalist with The Economist in London. Such fascinating information, James. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Well, this afternoon on All Things Considered, Israel's parliament lets expire a law that prevented Palestinian citizens from extending citizenship to spouses from the West Bank and Gaza. But as you will hear, that doesn't mean things will change in practice. You can ask your smart speaker to play NPR or ask for your member station by name. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Here and Now.